This is Dr. Laura Falkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Paula D. Wright. Today's date is the 11th of August, 2004, and Paula and I are sitting together in the interview room in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech. And Paula, I want to welcome you back. Thank you for making time to come back and help us learn more about your experiences in Vietnam. Let me start by asking about the point at which we left off yesterday, which has to do with the end of your tour. You were telling me that you had a short-timer's calendar that you have found at home. And I wonder if there were any events that happened as you came to the end of your tour that you wanted to talk about. Anything that you remember about leaving?
Well, this is, like I told you in my email to you last month, this is poignant because on the 9th of August, today is August 11th, 2005, on August 9th, 1970, we lost six people that day.
Yeah, let me ask you, if you don't mind, Paula, to tell me what you feel comfortable with about what happened that day.
I think I can talk about it.
If you feel all right.
I feel all right.
Okay.
It was a Saturday. And we went out, and we had one of our helicopters shot down. It was a gunship, and we got the crew chief and the gunner and the pilot. I should say door gunner, because the co-pilot in a gunship is considered the gunner. But anyway, the crew chief and the door gunner got out. The co-pilot got out when the chopper crashed. It caused the instrument panel to be crushed, trapping the pilot in. So we had to leave here.
We can just take a little break right now.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead, Paul.
Anyway, the helicopter was on fire, and we were trying to get him out. And we couldn't get him out, and so he told us to leave him there. So had to leave him there.
He spoke to you?
Huh?
He was speaking to you?
Well,
to
one of the other guys in my platoon
was there.
Mm-hmm. I can't remember where I was flying, but I was in a different, mm-hmm. on a different mission.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to him about that and everything and the other guys. And then about 6:15 that night, we got a mortar attack. And it seemed like they'd always hit us like between 6 o'clock. For a while there, it was like for a week we'd get hit between 6 and 6:30 every day. And then, you know, other times it'd be, you know, different times during the day.
Just always sporadic.
Yeah, sporadic. Mm-hmm. But they knew they were trying to hit the mess hall because they knew we'd eat, we ate. So they, but anyway, then, like I said, about 6:30, and we got a mortar attack, and one hit the squad, maintenance squad that I was working in. They were working that night. They were trying to get it out, and the guy that took my place, shrapnel hit him at the back of his neck, and it just cut him where you just, so I mean, he'd been in the country only a week, been in our unit for 3 days.
Was he killed immediately?
Oh yes. Yes. But I mean, while I remember that is, you know, it could have been me. Because like I said, he took my place in the maintenance platoon,
Do you know his name?
I did at the time, but I've...
I understand.
I put it back.
I understand.
But a day later, we had the memorial service for him, and I could still see the boots, the helmets, the uniforms, all lined up across the stage. So this is the 35th anniversary of that. So I guess this interview is more poignant to me now.
But it's fitting that you remember him in this way too. This honors his service, that you remember him, that you were there, and that you feel able to talk about that puts him, you know, on the record.
Mm-hmm. So I know a week later, on the 16th, and why I said it was a Saturday, because we started calling it Black Saturday, because we had so many, you know, we had like a total of like 15 people wounded, but those 6 killed, so like a almost 3-1 ratio, which is, I'm really glad, because I wish it had been 18 killed, I mean 18 wounded instead of killed. But that's the, you know.
Yes.
Back to the, you know, the chaplain will come up and he says, you know, the preachers always come up and talk about when somebody dies young and the Lord's purpose, you know, he had fulfilled his service on life. Mm-hmm.
Did that comfort you at all?
Not really.
Has it since?
No, not really.
Really? Haven't changed on that?
So, and it gives me and every other veteran that ever served in combat guilt complex.
And you feel that still, obviously?
Yes, because, you know, why them? You know, because you... you're taught from the time you go into the military until you get out, you don't leave your buddies behind. You protect your buddies. And even now, in the veterans organizations I belong to, that's what we still think that.
Yes, yes.
We're buddies. You know, might not agree with what you, might not like you, might not agree with you.
But you still have this common.
But we're still buddies, and we'll fight for what you need.
Yes.
And support whatever you do.
Well, so. Paula, let me ask about when you left Vietnam in December, I gather, December of 1970.
December 8th.
What was your next posting?
My next posting was Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Okay. And how long were you there?
I was there for 8 months.
And what did you do?
I was... excuse me, you want to talk to?
Sure. Well, what were you doing on this stateside assignment?
I was a helicopter mechanic again. I got in and I was a CIS crew chief.
What was your MOS number?
My MOS was 67 November 20, which is UH-1 single turbine rudder utility helicopter.
Okay. And so you continued to do that kind of work.
I can continue to do that and everything. Of course, we didn't fly as much. And, you know, this is back in the States, and we didn't fly that much and everything. So basically, what I'd I got bored because I was sitting around playing cards all day with the POL guys.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I finally started working with the maintenance, guy, working on maintenance.
Well, how did it come about that you went back to Vietnam?
I re-enlisted in March of 71.
Okay.
And got a $10,000 bonus.
Is that why you re-enlisted, or what was driving you? What was your motivation?
Well, actually, what's funny, I'll go back. I'd been in country. I'd been in the unit a week or 10 days,
mm-hmm.
and I went to formation one day, and they came up, and usually you have to spend, for unmarried, a year tour. For married, usually 18-month tour.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got married. And actually, what I had requested an extension, a 3-month extension in Vietnam, so because I wasn't until after my 21st birthday, because my parents said they weren't going to, sign to let me get married. And so I said, well, if I'm 21, mm-hmm. they can't do anything. Well, they came up and gave me a drop. Two days after I requested my extension, they gave me a 45-day drop. And so I was afraid, I kept my mouth shut. And in fact, at the headquarters, I asked them, I got sent to battalion headquarters and went to personnel. They said, well, we don't have your orders yet. And I said, yeah, they're going to send me back because in the paperwork I signed, it said that if I got a drop, I would, waive it. Well, I guess somebody in battalion lost the paperwork. But anyway, so I thought maybe they caught that. And they had got me and somebody else. His and my last four were the same numbers. The last two numbers were switched. Like mine is 9-4.
Right.
His was 4-9.
Huh.
So he came up from Vietnam, so they couldn't find him. So they sent it to me, and so they thought I was going back to Vietnam. And I re-enlisted and got a $10,000 bonus. And this sounds stupid, but it seemed logical. They came up and took $2,500 out for taxes.
Yeah.
And so I went back and that pissed me off and everything. And they switched me to a different job, which I didn't like. And so I said, to hell with this shit. I'll go back to Vietnam. One thing, I'll get my money, all my $2,500 back. And I said, screw it, I'll go back to Vietnam, Screw you. You don't like me,
Yeah. That was your attitude?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you got sent back. You did get sent to
Vietnam. I got all of it back. It took me a year, but I got the money. I got the money back.
Well, you went back to start your second tour in the middle of 71. Then is that?
I went. I got there August. Every time I got transferred, I left the unit, and I had to report on the 16th of the month. I don't know why they did that to me. Where like a lot of the people that were married and everything, they would like the first of the month or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Me, I always got 16th. The 16th of the month. And what was bad and everything, turning off signal.
Sure. So your arrival back in Vietnam, what did it feel like to be back there? I mean, did it bring up stuff, or were you ready to go and all right? Somewhere in between, maybe.
Really, it hadn't changed that much. It seemed like I hadn't left.
I believe it.
You get there and, the airplane opens and that jet fuel and charcoal and the Vietnamese, they cooked on charcoal. They heated their house with charcoal. They cooked on charcoal. I remember when we'd take off in the mornings the first time. We'd take off, we'd fly over the village, and the first 500 feet, or first 100 feet would be just like going through a black smoke, you know, the charcoal smoke, and that smell and everything, you know, and I can't barbecue. I mean, you know, I smell a charcoal fire and I think of that.
Even now. Where did you get assigned this time?
I got assigned up to 101st Airborne Division. It was 10 miles from the DMZ. I was at Camp Evans, 101st Airborne, 3rd Brigade, 101st Airborne.
And now Camp Evans was huge, right? I mean, it was a big complex.
Yeah, it was big. Farther north, they had some fire bases north of us.
Right.
I think the 5th Division, 5th Infantry Division, was just a few miles up the road from us, and then they got stood down right before I got back over there, or right shortly after, because we were the last American major base there on the north.
Up on the DMZ area.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Up by the... Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were 10 miles from... We were a mile and a half from Asha.
The Asha Valley. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
I've always said Asha.
That's fine.
Asha.
What did your daily work look like?
I got there and I was supposed to go to C Company, 159th Aviation, take over, be a crew chief on one of the helicopters.
Yeah.
And that's what I was assigned for. Mm-hmm. And in the in-country replacement, they had changed my orders to D Company, which was the gunship, Cobra Company. By this time, we had switched from the C model Cobra gunship Huey.
The C model Huey to the Cobra.
To the Cobra.
Right. And you said yesterday that it really, from a maintenance point of view, was not all that different.
No.
To work on the two different ships.
No.
I mean, obviously,
the frame, the basic frame was the same thing as the Huey, just to streamline shorter. Mm-hmm. Had the pilot and the gunner. They were, let's say, tandems side by side. I keep getting that confused. Aircraft mechanic, and I don't know the difference between them. But anyway, the pilot was pilot sit front, and the gunner sit behind him.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't like it because I didn't get to fly. I could have been a crew chief, but you don't fly. So there goes your $55 a month.
Was that the pay difference?
Right. Flight pay was $55 a month.
But did you also care that you would have rather have flown?
Yes.
Not just the 55 bucks. I mean, that's important.
I'd rather fly. Well, I mean, you know, that's why all these guys are going, well, you can volunteer, jump out of your airplane, you'll be a paratrooper. Hey, why should, you know, paratroop pay and flight pay is the same amount of money. Why should I leave a perfectly good, functionally good aircraft and walk when I can fly? You know, I'm sorry, I might be Army, but these feet don't walk unless they have to.
Were there any attacks on Evans while you were there that you remember?
No. Ashley, we had the worst thing we had was a typhoon. And it was really funny. I'll rest a little bit. When I got to Fort Rucker, Alabama, 2 days later, we had Hurricane Cecilia hit us.
Mm-hmm.
Then I get to Vietnam, and they're not only trying to shoot at us and kill us and bomb, you know, frag us or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but we had to sit there for 3 days of a typhoon. And we were like half a mile from the coast, South China Sea.
And you guys were getting battered, probably.
And they let the pilot, they flew the helicopters out, so the pilots got to go out, but they left us there.
That's right. So how bad was it? Can you describe it?
Oh, God. Wind, constant roar, constant rain. And I mean, all you can do is sleep.
Right.
Or listen to the, you know.
Yeah.
Or listen to the rain. And we had to go out. I was lucky because what I worked in, the hooch I worked in, well, I worked in maintenance for a while. And a couple of months, something like that. And then I got can't remember what happened near the thing. Anyway, I went to somebody, they needed communication people. And so I said, yeah, I was born to do, you know. Well, I raced the stink and everything because I tried to get out of the unit and go into the slick unit. And using the old boy, I re-enlisted as a UH-1,
crew chief
and everything like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I was told that I would be that for 3 years and, you know, or 18 months, guaranteed 18 months and everything. And so, you know, I tried to deal and everything. So, you know,
but that did
maintenance sergeant said, well, if you don't want us around here, if you don't want to be here, why do I want you here?
And
so, you know, which really wasn't, no sweat off my back.
Mm-hmm. So you got moved.
So I moved over to, they said, well, we need somebody in the communication section. And so I operated switchboard for a while, and I strung the telephone wires for the field phones, stuff mm-hmm. like that. Did mm-hmm. that for a while. I just couldn't. People can't understand this. Flying does not scare me, but I'm scared of heights.
Mm-hmm.
I said, if you don't like it, scared of heights, why do you fly? I said, flying doesn't scare me. It's that sudden stop after the fall that scares me.
Right, right.
You know, I've been that way since.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And you know, and my oldest boy is the same way. And I mean, with him growing up, I tried to get him, you know, teach him to not have the same fears that I did and everything like that. I so it might be hereditary. I don't know.
Yeah, they say that it is.
You know,
you're born with
but
it.
My, you know, but I mean, he doesn't mind climbing and everything, but you know, he'll do it. But he has. So, but anyway, I did that for a while,
mm-hmm.
and then they come up. The first sergeant needed somebody to run the details. And we had a Vietnamese boy and three or four momassans that would go around, pick stuff up, clean stuff up, and do minor maintenance around the stuff and everything. So he needed somebody to do that. So I did that for I guess it was 2 months altogether. I was in maintenance and then communication. And then the last 8 weeks I was in the unit, I did the detail stuff, and then we got orders to. They stood the unit down and sent the unit back home, and it hatched me out because I got in the country like the 18th of August, left here the 16th, got there the 18th, but I didn't get to my unit until about a week later because at that time they considered it like high VC activity, so they would not transport us to the. Take us from Benoit to, or from Long Bend to Benoit, because they're afraid the, of course, you know, we're unarmed. And so, you know, so they're afraid that, you know,
we'd be targeted
mm-hmm. and everything. Mm-hmm. If I had been, like the first tour, if I had got there as soon as I'd gotten country, I would have had enough time in country or in the unit to go back to the unit. And so that would have meant I would have had an 8 month drop.
But instead,
I got stuck.
You got transferred.
I got transferred to 1st Cav Division, Benoit, 3rd Brigade.
And this was am I right in saying this is with the 229th?
Right.
And that was part of the 1st Cav?
Yes. It was 229th. It's how the 1st Cav had it, and it's really funny because I've I always wanted to be in the calf because I thought the calf, because one thing, the first calf proved that air mobility would work.
Yes.
The first calf proved that they did helicopter evacuation for medevacs in Korea.
Earlier. Mm-hmm.
But the first calf proved that it worked, proved that we saved 99% of the casualties that were killed. It was able to, you know, to be saved.
Right. Get them from the battlefield out of there.
From the battlefield out to a mobile evacuation hospital.
Right.
And everything. I just always, and of course, and it's really like I said yesterday, like I told you yesterday, mm-hmm. I ended up in Colonel Custer's outfit.
So the 7th?
First of the 7th Cav. Mm-hmm. And that was, and the brigades, they had 3 brigades, 1st Brigade, 2nd Brigade, 3rd Brigade. And the aviation for the 1st Brigade was 227, for the 2nd was 228, and for the 3rd was 229. So that's how the other two division headquarters and the other two brigades had been taken back, sent back to Fort Hood, Texas. So we were 3rd Brigade forward.
And this is at Benoit?
At Benoit, mm-hmm. Yeah. Benoit, the first time I was up there, Benoit was the division headquarters of the 1st Cav Division.
Right.
But really what's funny is Camp Evans and everything like this used to be 1st Cav until the 101st came over.
Early on, that's
early
right.
Early on.
Yeah.
And the A-Shy, the 1st Cav went in, and they went in, they put out deals, and they says, this is the year of the horse, we are the horse, bud, we're going to kick your butt.
This is the 1965 battles mm-hmm. in the Yadrong Valley and all that, with the 1st Cav, and the 1st Cav and the 1st of the 7th.
1st of the 7th was the first combat unit
right.
in Vietnam. They had the first American Vietnamese major battle.
Right. North Vietnamese.
North Vietnamese
yeah.
battle.
Yeah.
In fact, the film, we were, what's the name of it? We were young and brave.
We were soldiers once.
We were soldiers young and brave.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That is the actual true how the story of the 1st and 7th Cav.
Yeah. And you must have been in some way a little torn. I mean, wish that you'd gone home, but
I was torn because, well, my mother-in-law came up and said, well, I guess Falls got tired of it because I got married on December 27th and here, you know, 8 months, like, you know, 7 months, 7.5 months later, I was shipping out.
Right.
You know, so, yes, I was torn because I missed that. And what's really funny is when I got to the 101st, or got to the 101st, instead of putting me, I had made an allotment, had most of my money go to my ex, and I took $25 a month because I didn't need that much.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, I had 3 square meals a day and a place to sleep.
So the salary was basically staying with your wife.
So, because we had bought a new house and our trailer.
Uh-huh.
And it was a house to us.
Sure.
You know, so she had to pay, you know, had a new car.
Yeah.
So, you know, had bills to pay and everything. And anyway, I got, first month came around and I didn't get paid, so I went down to Division. Well, okay, next month you'll get paid. Next month, I didn't get paid for 3 months.
Hmm.
My wedding anniversary on December 27th, I walked over to the air base, and they had a Mars station over there with a direct phone line from Vietnam to Oakland Army Base. And then so all I had to do was pay for the phone call from Oakland to wherever it was in the States. And so I got permission to go over there, and it was after work, but our squad was working on the helicopter. Because
right.
it had flown that day, and we were getting it, you know, taking it down for us. So I got permission to take off work and go over there and call because it was my first anniversary.
Right.
I found out that they had me listed as missing in action, and that was why I wasn't getting paid.
And that had been true for 3 months?
And that had been true since August. And this was December.
Had they told your wife that you were missing in action? That's very strange.
Not until she wouldn't get paid and everything. So I kept saying, well, okay, all the paperwork she'd write me and I'd write back and I'd tell her and everything. Well, so finally what she did and everything, she went to the finance officer there at Fort Knox.
Mm-hmm.
And she found out December 24th. They called up and everything, and he says, okay, we got all this paperwork and everything like this, so what we need you to do is we need you to go to the... Of course, the last 2 weeks I was at in the 101st, they wouldn't let us write. We could get mail, but they wouldn't let us write because of security concerns.
Okay.
Because they knew, they was afraid, and the people going home, they were allowed one phone call, say, I'm coming home. I'll be home soon. But they couldn't say a date. We knew a date. And really, that's stupid because, I mean, you know.
They were trying to prevent.
If somebody knows the date, mm-hmm. it's going to get around.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
You
but
mean,
yet, they
yeah.
didn't, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
you know.
In Vietnam, that.
Right. The security, you know, mm-hmm. like World War II and everything like this. And,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, you know, really, Vietnam was different from... I've seen letters that my uncle had sent and everything like this, and you can see where it's censored. You know what I mean?
Right. Yes.
So Vietnam was we were not censored. We could talk about whatever we wanted to and everything. We'd tell them where he was at and everything.
And do you think that was a mistake?
No.
No.
I mean, it was put on the news anyway, so.
Really? So it wouldn't have made... It wasn't a security breach in that sense because
no.
the information was already available.
Right. Yeah. One thing I did see is that I never thought I would see. We had a general order signed by the commanding general of the 101st saying that we could not talk or give rights to any correspondent unless they had approval from general headquarters.
By correspondent, you mean an American news correspondent?
American news, any correspondent.
That's strange. Did you ever see one? Did you ever see news people over there?
Mm-hmm. I was on national news one day.
What happened? How'd that happen?
I was getting a helicopter, go down to the USS Corpus Christi to pick up some parts that was being repaired, some instruments that were being repaired.
Uh-huh.
I was waiting for the helicopter to come out. I turned around about 100 yards away. I saw this guy with a very big old news camera and everything like this, you know, taking pictures like this.
Yeah.
I flip him the peace sign and everything. And a week later, I get a letter from home. I saw you on NBC News last night.
No kidding.
Really?
Oh,
and I mean, they zoomed in on me. I didn't... And, you know...
So you were doing the peace sign.
I was doing the peace sign.
Cool. That's actually pretty neat.
Yeah, no.
Well, it was probably exciting. I mean, they must have been thrilled when they recognized that it was you.
Barbara did, you know.
Yeah, that would be your wife.
Yeah,
right?
That was my wife. I don't know. My parents, they... I don't know what they didn't see it. In
well, she must have been darn excited too.
Yeah,
have been able
she
to
said
see
we, she was over at she was back at Fort Knox. Excuse me, and she was over at. it's funny. The lady's name was Antoinette, and we called her Tony.
Mm-hmm.
Her husband's name was Jack. And why I'm getting into this is well, anyway, so they was over there. And they were playing Pinochle.
Mm-hmm.
That must be an Eastern game, Eastern United States, because I haven't found anybody.
No, not out here.
Yeah, played me. Well, I take that back. Some guys that went to UT played Pinochle in basic.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, that's just. Anyhow, they were playing Pinochle, and she was sitting there, you know, listening, And I said, we go to our correspondent, so-and-so, in Bidwell, Army Base, Vietnam. And so she happens to look up, and she sees me, and she goes, that's Paul, that's Paul.
That must have been quite a moment.
And so she said, you know, she knew, well, she hadn't heard from me for a few days, so.
She knew you were okay.
She knew I was all right. And I asked her and everything like this. She says, I said, what did you call my parents? She said, no, I didn't think about it. She called her cousins that we stayed with her when we first got out there. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, her cousin was in Vietnam same time mm-hmm. I was mm-hmm. for his second, and I think it was his third tour.
Wow.
So,
wow.
At least second tour.
Now, this happened in December? Or?
Well, no, this happened like, you know.
Earlier.
No, let's see. This happened like in February or March.
Oh, okay.
It happened in February.
72.
Okay. Why I say that is because I went home on R&R in March and she, you know.
When you say you went home, did you go to Hawaii or did you go all the way home?
It was cheaper. They came up and I was going to, it was really the first time I was there. I was going to pay for Barbie Jean to fly over to Hawaii. And I talked to our chaplain, and he got me in touch with the chaplain that he knew there in Hawaii. And we was going to meet there and get married, and I get a letter from Barbie Jean, and she talked to my parents, my mother, and mother talked her into, and she came up and she says, I'll shack up with you, I'll shack up with you, but I won't marry you. And then I come back, make an honest woman out of her anyway. So, yeah, I mean, you know, if we just, well, I don't know. But the idea that maybe, and I agree with Mom and everything that, you know, if I got back, you know, well, one thing, what if I was wounded? What if I got killed? Mm-hmm. You know, spend a week together for a honeymoon and get killed. Or what if I come back and I'm disabled? You know, physically, where she had to take care of me. I mean, you know, I'm disabled, but I'm just a little crazy, you know. It's not, nothing bad.
You can get around.
Yeah, but anyway, you know, certified by the VA crazy. But anyway.
Well, let me ask about going back to the first cab and the time that you spent with them. What was the feeling? I mean, we're talking about 1972. What was the feeling in the unit that you were in terms of, you know, whether the war was going to end soon, American involvement was drawing down?
We had gone down from standard strength of like 500,000 other soldiers down to, and I mean, we were rank heavy. I had got promoted to E5. Mm-hmm. Before I left 101st, Acton Jack, mm-hmm. which meant if I kept it for 30 days in combat, it would have been permanent. 2 weeks or two, 3 weeks after I got promoted, we got our stand-in orders. And so I said, what's going to happen? I said, well, you're going as an E5. Yeah. As soon I get the first cab, and I said, what happens to my E5? Well, that depends on your first sergeant. As soon as I report to the first sergeant, I'm no longer an E5, I'm an E4. A squad has one NCO, an E5, a corporal, let's see, there's 12 people, so that's two, eight, four or five E4s, PFCs, and E1s. Our squad, the lowest rank was E4 or E3. No, okay. You take the back as E3.
So there were just a couple people below you.
Right.
And they needed you to be further down.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'd be too top heavy as a squad.
Well, we were too top heavy. We had, squad leader was the E5. We had E5s going private to the guard.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Well, by 1972, that doesn't surprise me. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, the last herd, like when I got there in August of 72, I'd say we had like a total of like 50,000. by February, it was down to 25,000.
Right.
And it seemed like every single one was at Benoit. But, I mean, we were the last combat unit left, active combat unit left in Vietnam.
And how far afield were the helicopters going? I mean, were they going all the way out to the border?
We was going all over.
All over the place. So the mission area wasn't restricted at this point.
No. Okay. Mission area, the Vietnamese had completely taken over I Corps and 2 Corps.
Right.
We had 3 Corps and 4 Corps.
So you might have choppers that were going all the way down to the Delta.
Right.
In the course of a day.
Right.
Okay, and coming back.
Right.
What were the losses? I mean, I'm just wondering how many hits were the choppers taking in the course of a day? Would they come back with bullet holes? Were they still taking fire?
Yes, they were still taking fire and everything, some and everything. I'll tell you what happened in April. They come up and they says, oh, you know, we're standing the unit down. We're sending the brigade home. You know, folding the collar and, you know, sending them back to Fort Hood and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they come up and everything and they says, all right, I'm getting me a 4-month drop.
Right, and?
So, I process out. Go to Camp Alpha.
This is in April.
April.
Uh-huh.
72.
Uh-huh.
Process out. Go to Camp Alpha. Get up the next morning. Get on the bus. Go through customs. Get on the plane. Get on the bus. Coming up and everything. Get off the bus. Getting ready to go on the airplane. MPG Jeep pulls up. Me and two other guys are pulled out and sent back to the unit.
What explanation did they give you? Any? I mean, did they?
The NVA was 25 miles away from Benoit. This is when the NVA started the spring offensive.
Yes.
The Vietnamese and everything, within 2 days, they had completely taken over the First Corps.
Yes.
I Corps. You asked if I had any Ashton and Evans and everything. I didn't, but we left, the 21st or 21st of December, New Year's Eve. It got heavily shelled. And how I found that out is I saw they had an Air Force radar site that controlled the strikes up in Hanoi and Haiphong.
Yes.
And I knew one of the Air Force guys, and I met him at Camp Alpha when I was going on R&R, and he told me about it. And he said it was a heavy artillery rocket, everything, and a ground attack. And he said he lost everything they got because all they did, they had enough time to fly shit hoods in and get them out, and that was it.
And this was up at Evans.
This was up at Evans.
And so in April.
So I mean, I like so.
So you had some preparation, some idea of what. How much progress the NVA had made.
Well, I mean, this happened like in December of the deal and everything. And so, I mean, I knew. Yeah. And, I mean, we had. It didn't surprise me that was going, you know, that the units were folding.
But how heartbroken were you when you got pulled off the flight line practically to.
If I had a gun, I would have hijacked the aircraft.
I believe you.
If we had been, because what pissed me off, if we had been in the airplane and the door shut,
you would have been.
They would have left us alone. Because once they shut that door, they had only a certain amount of time to be on the ground.
Right.
So how close were you?
10 minutes or less from getting on the plane?
5 minutes. 3 minutes. Because I was getting off the bus, we were lining up, standing in line to get on the plane.
So they came through and said, right, you're with me?
They called the names and everything like this. And
okay. And these are MPs that were doing this?
Well, MPs, it was somebody from Camp Alpha and everything. You know.
Right. And so they said, you need to get back up here?
So they said, you're going with, you know, you've been pulled. They didn't tell us what happened. They said, you've been pulled off the flight. They just told us that. they didn't tell us until we got back to Camp Alpha. Whatever. They're not dumb.
Right.
They knew we would, you know.
Well, maybe not that bad, but...
I mean, yes, I was... But anyway, heated up. But I spent the next 72 hours humping rockets, working 12 on, 12 off, humping rockets, because all we had at that time was anti-personnel rockets, and they had T-54 tanks that they were going against, trying to stop.
Now, these are the rockets that were loaded onto the undercarriage of the helicopters.
Yes.
And what kind of rockets were they?
They were anti-personnel.
So that's not going to do much against a tank, is it?
They just bounce off.
So that's pretty dangerous for the guys who are flying.
So what they did, so, you know, if you get the, if you get it underneath the turret, yeah, it would...
Right.
You know what I mean?
And you might get infantry who might be walking with the tank.
Yeah, and everything. But I mean, as far as in...
Taking the tanks out, that was the way to do it.
Not taking the tank out. And at that time, I was glad. And I wanted to fly then, but yet they had so many other people that, well, in a roundabout way, I did want to fly. But first time, I was single, young, you know, the old expression, young, dumb, full of cum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, I was married. I had a little bit more responsibility. Yes, it would have been nice to fly and everything. If I had a chance to fly, yeah, I would have taken it.
But you didn't. That didn't.
But
come.
I did. But so they had too many people. They had too many people that wanted to fly.
When you say you were humping rockets, are you saying that you were moving the rockets from wherever they were stored to?
Okay. What it was? They flew. At that time, they had the first TOW, which is tactical optical weapon, in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wire-guided anti-tank rocket. Well, they didn't expect. We didn't have any in Vietnam because that was an unconventional warfare. You know, jungle warfare and everything like this, you know. We had tanks, but you didn't expect, you know. Yeah, you didn't expect. So what they did is airlifted, you know, C-5 to the helicopters from Germany.
Yeah.
Nonstop.
Yeah.
And they based them there. And so what they did, and so they also with the C-5, they left the ammunition at Saigon under more secure, because really we were told not to expect to. Well, I'll put it this way. They said write all your personal stuff down besides your military, you know, like my work, you know, uniform, stuff like that. Turn it in, and we'll keep it. Because they were talking about your thing, you know, if it got too bad, we was going to boogie out.
Meaning bug out, fold up,
bug out.
Get out of there.
Now,
to Saigon, presumably? Or did you not know?
Well, they said we'd bug out to Benoit.
Okay.
And then if we had to be, then they said, by that time, we should have the 141s and, you know, whatever here to take you out.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we were going to let them have everything. Blow the helicopters in place.
Blow them up.
Blow them up.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's kind of...
It's very
gives you an incentive.
It's
so what
very
they
nerve wracking.
So what they and
I mean, I
like we
imagine.
Had a rearm point and everything, but yet really not. Well, one thing, we didn't have the area to store the ammunition that they needed.
Okay.
And so what they did, they'd fly enough ammunition to arm everything, and take them off, and then they bring in more.
Okay.
While they were out.
So this is kind of an airlift of ammo, effectively, into the base.
Right.
So the helicopters could be armed and fly out. Is that
right?
And they were doing this many times a day.
We flew 24/7.
For at least 3 days, or was it longer than that?
For at least 3 days.
And did you get any time off in there, or were you running
pretty much? We worked 12 hours.
12-12?
12-12.
Okay. And
really with that and everything was going on, it got close enough we could hear the artillery was going off all the time.
Yeah.
That was even in, you know, they fly the 105 shells in and set it right there by, you know.
Now after this period, this 3 or 4 day period that was really intense.
We stopped them 5 miles from Benoit.
The NVA.
Uh-huh.
And what happened next over the next few weeks? Did you guys?
Well, we was able to take over the areas, retake over the areas and everything.
Was it pretty much constant? Battle stations effectively. You guys were working to keep the choppers in the air.
We were wearing flat vests and steel pots.
No kidding.
And underwear.
Yeah.
Uniform regulation was relaxed just a little bit.
And this is, we're talking about now probably May.
This
72?
Is like April.
May.
April 72 and everything, mostly, you know. So I can't, it might have been May. I don't know. I just remember,
when,
you know.
When did you actually then get to finally leave Vietnam?
I was supposed to, and I left June 30th, 1972.
I mean, this is pretty much right close to the end.
But see, they told me, they said, your tour is extended until your DROS date. You know what DROS is?
Explain it for people, if you would.
Date expected return from overseas. Everybody had a 12. You had to spend 10 months, at least 10 months, in country.
Right.
To qualify for a drop. For a tour was to consider 10 months. 10 months, 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why 10 months, 5 days. Why not 10 months? You know what I mean? You know, what? Or, yeah,
there's no
why
explaining
not 10
it.
Days, 1 month?
Right.
You know, or 10 days, 1 week?
There's no explaining it.
You know.
But anyway, that's what it was. And
everything. So, the first time I spent over there, 10 months, 29 days, 12 hours, 54 minutes. Don't ask me in seconds. I don't know. Sorry, that was smart ass.
That's all right, but you got it pretty closely figured.
Actually, why I know that and everything like this, it's because on my discharge papers, on your 214s,
yes.
They give the exact amount of time you spent in a combat zone.
Yeah, yeah. Would do you have a copy of your DD-214?
Yes, I do.
Would you mind depositing one here?
No.
A copy of it, I mean, obviously, to add to the collection.
Yeah,
here.
No problem.
And let me ask what it felt like to I assume you flew home.
Mm-hmm.
What was the plane ride like?
Get back a little bit. Well, I went to work, and what had me up is when I was working, when they pulled me off, I wasn't even working in my MOS. They had put me in another job. I was working in, I was working in maintenance, but I was in charge of the hydraulic shop.
And they had done this to you a couple times before, where they
and
had
so
you
I mean, you know, like, well, you're 67 November, you're not a, you know what I mean, and so you know your MOS is critical.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I didn't mind, you know what I mean. You know, if I was doing my job, that'd be different.
But they had you sidelined.
They had me sidelined and everything, you know,
hydraulic stuff. Yeah.
So doing hydraulics and everything, which is, you know. I mean, a little bit. That's how I got put on TV, because I had the hydraulic shop, and then also the special tool shed, and one of our we kept all the testing equipment. One of our test equipments had to be repaired, so that's how I got ended up.
I see.
Because we needed it, you know, and so they flew me down to, you know.
That's how you happen to be.
That's how it happened. That's how I happened to them. And that happened like in, you know, like in February.
Right, right.
But in March I did get to go home all the way, went all the way home, took 1 week R&R. Well, I found out it was cheaper for me to fly all the way home than it was for my ex.
To go to Hawaii. Right, yeah.
So, and, you know, and it's a shock to go from 110 degree day in your thing and you land in Louisville, Kentucky, to Kentucky. There's 2 inch, there's half an inch of snow, of ice on the ground and 6 inches of snow. And all you are is in a light light clothes.
That's right. You're in your
And
right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
look like a Mexican.
Well, when the next time that you were able to fly to the States was your demobilization,
well,
essentially.
Yeah, or actually what came up is I had went out for formation. Is it? I liked this unit because we only had formation one day. Every Monday we'd have formation. Rest of the time, if you didn't have to work, you didn't get, you know, you didn't get up.
Right, right.
Yeah. You gotta work when you gotta work, you know, when you gotta work. So I was off and somebody came banging on my door and said, woke me up. And said, first sergeant wants to see you. And I said, okay. I'm going, what the hell do I do now, you know?
Right.
And I said, you know, so I walked in and he says, here's your orders. It's your post. I mean, I went from, let's say I was supposed to leave the 16th of August, so 31, 47, 49 day drop.
And you were out of there how fast?
2 days. That happened at 8 o'clock in the morning. At 5:30 the next morning, they came and woke me up. And I said, you got 30 minutes to turn your shit in and get to brigade headquarters. Mm-hmm. Within 24 hours, I was home. They came up. I was waiting. They took me to division headquarters, or brigade headquarters. And it still, they still called it division because it was first. Well, in April, we were changed from 3rd Brigade forward to Task Force Gary Owens. Because first the 7th was, that was Colonel Custer's outfit.
Right, right.
So, in fact, our brigade song was the Gary Owens. So that's how, but anyway. And somewhere I have my orders, and my orders were signed by, personally, not by President Nixon. It was presidential direction sending us home, pulling us out.
That sounds right. The end of June. 1972.
So yeah, usually it says for the Adjutant General and everything like this, or you know, it says by, you know,
authority
the DOP or whatever. Yeah. RMM, Richard Buellhouse Nixon.
I didn't know they
were presidential orders until that morning. I was waiting at brigade, or at battalion headquarters, excuse me. And what's funny is what our battalion headquarters was the first year was the in-country replacement Vietnam training center that I went to. So, I mean, you know, that was like
full circle.
Yep, you know what I mean? I'm back where I started.
Right, right.
You know, everything.
Well,
so
when you first got home,
they came up. Well, I'm sorry. They came up and they told us. They said, "Okay, so we can have you on the plane." Said it is 10 o'clock. We can have you in Saigon in 2 hours, and you will be leaving tomorrow morning. if you don't want to process out and get, wait till you get back to the States to get paid. If you wait here, it will be tomorrow before we can get you to Saigon. And by this time, they'd shut down Long Bend, the replacement company, and everybody's going through Camp Alpha in Saigon at Thompson Up. You know what? I was the first one in line. Process me out.
Get me out of here.
Are you sure you don't, you want me? Because I knew as soon as I got, I knew we had to go, well, they had changed to Dolby, but I knew we had to go back to Oakland. You know what I mean? So, anyway, they operate at 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
You get there at 2 o'clock in the morning, you can get paid at 2:30.
Right.
And at 5 o'clock, you're on a Freedom Bird.
Right.
You know. So, I said, are you sure? You know. You said, you got any money? I said, well, I got it in the bank account. I got my checkbook.
Right.
You know. What do I need? You know. How much? You want me to write you a check for the flight?
Yeah.
Yeah. Give me to Hawaii, I'll get home.
Right. You were way willing to go.
You know what I'm talking about? You know.
Well, and when you got home, those first days, how did it go? I mean,
it was great.
I mean, not only being glad to be home, but did you get any gruff from anybody about them obviously recognizing that you had been in Vietnam?
No, because I was still at Fort Knox, and so I mean, yeah,
you're still in Con.
Yeah, I was still in Knox, but I got, it was funny. I got back to Oakland or Travis, and they come up and we get out and everything like this. And what I said, they changed it up. They come up and they said, okay, the ones that got paid over in Vietnam, get on the bus. That bus is taking you straight to San Francisco International so you can catch your flight.
Right.
You know, if you didn't get paid, get on that bus, so take it back to Oakland. I got back 30 minutes too late, and it was the end. That's before the fiscal year was in the 1st of July. They had shut down the balance of the book. So I spent all night, and I spent 3.5 hours on the telephone with my wife.
Yeah.
And the Army paid for it.
Good for you. Well, they ought to have. Good for you.
Because the CQ and everything, the guy that was there and everything like this, he just...
Gave you the phone?
He gave me the phone. He looked at it this way. He said, you come back and everything, you deserve it.
Go ahead.
Got there, flew in, had to wait. And overnight and everything, like I said, I called. And of course, I didn't even call from Japan. We stopped off in the only time I flew to Hawaii is when I went on R&R. The rest of the time I went the northern route. You know, Japan, Alaska, you know that. I flew to Hawaii. R&R. Flew to the Philippines, Guam, you know. So, waited and everything. And she got pissed because she told me, if you had told me I would have flown out there waiting, I'd be waiting for you.
You didn't. Yeah, you didn't have time.
No, really, we did. Because, I don't know what she would have done. She would have hopped in the car and driven out there. You know?
Yeah.
No, I mean, she would have.
Yeah.
I knew.
Well, I well believe that.
You know? And everybody
so
said
anxious.
She, because that's what she told me. She told me, she says, I will be in Oakland at the reception, at the transient barracks or guest house.
When you get there.
August, when you get there. Come by the guest house. I'll be waiting for you. So
but the next day you were able to fly out to...
So they took me and I got paid. They did open it up at 6 o'clock, so they didn't let me wait till 8. And by 12 o'clock I was headed home. So I got
and
this.
Let me ask, you remained on active duty for how long after that?
That was 72. I got out in 75.
Okay, and in the interim there, you served in Germany?
Mm-hmm. When I came back, I was Like I said, I got signed to Fort Carson, Colorado, because it was building the 4th Infantry Division.
Okay.
And what gets me is the guys that left, when we left and everything, General Hamlet, who was the brigade commander, and he was also the assistant division commander in the 101st. So he went from 101st to 1st Cav in 92.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he made 2-star, and he went to, he became the first black to command an army, a division in the continental United States. Mm-hmm. I got me and him and 11 other guys got sent to Fort Carson, Colorado. Everybody else got sent to Fort Hood. That pissed me off.
You didn't want to go. You
wanted to go back to. Yes, I wanted to be 4.5 hours away from home.
I can sure believe it.
Well, you know.
Because we're running out of time, let me just ask you a couple of other questions. You stayed on active duty. Where were you signed in Germany?
I was assigned at Würzburg, 3rd Infantry Division.
And did you do maintenance there too? Maintenance?
No.
What did they have you doing there?
I was a cook.
They had you cooking?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
When I was at Colorado Springs, they signed me to a... they had a total of 4 helicopters.
Yeah.
5. 2 medevacs, 2 Chinooks, and the general's helicopter.
Right.
And we had 175 crew chiefs.
So they found something else for you to do?
So they put me in maintenance, and they came up and they said, okay, fine, you can, since I was career status, so they came up and they said, well, we're going to make you excess, so you have your choice. Every job I wanted, I had to be an E5 or, you know, one of me,
mm-hmm.
and everything. So they sent me to a reclassification board. And they said, you got your choice between infantry, artillery, and cooking. Well, yeah. You know, this is Colorado Springs, Colorado. This is October 1973. Okay. In October of 1972, on October 31st, we had 6.5 feet of snow. We were fixing to go to the field for 30 days. I thought, okay. Tanks are made out of metal. Metal is cold. If I'm going to be in the field, if I cook, I'll be around a stove.
I'll be warm.
I'll be warm.
Good thinking. Well, you're...
So I went to cooking.
Did they try to get you to re-enlist again?
I came up, I think it was PTSD. I started having problems. Military problems. I got it busted down from E4 down to E1, and finally, and so they gave me a general's discharge. And really, come to find out, the attorney I had, he knew they were screwing me over and everything like this, and all this, and he kept saying, "Please let me ask for a board. They can't." Since your career status and everything, they cannot kick you out like this,
mm-hmm.
you know, without a board and hearing
mm-hmm.
and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I had an FTA attitude.
Yep.
You know, you want me to say what that means?
No, I think probably everybody
okay.
would get that.
All right. Okay.
Uh-huh.
You know, fired, you know.
And you were...
Intercourse the Army, you know. But anyway, I'll clean it up.
That's all right. Good.
I'll clean it up. So, I mean, you know... And, I mean, it's really funny. We had, every time you change uniforms, these and changes, you have an inspection to make sure your uniforms are up and everything. So it changed from winter to summer. So here we were in khakis and everything like this. I had my two rows of ribbons over here.
Right.
And my Silver Star, my Bronze Star, my Archive, my Good Conduct Medal. You know,
yeah.
I was there. Not only was there, but I forgot to duck. You know,
mm-hmm.
You know, all my ribbons and everything, my presidential citations, my Vietnamese awards, all that on this up. So, you know, 4 rows of ribbons and carrying a little old E1 stripe on me and everything, and everybody else there and everything, like, you know, E5 and E4s and everything like this. You know, I mean, looking at me and everything like this, you know, and I'm saying, and the only thing the officer could come up and say is my shoes weren't shined enough.
So that pretty much sums that up.
Yeah.
Well, let me.
He had to say something. It was an inspection.
Sure, of course. That's their job, right?
Right.
They have to say something.
What I'm saying, I was a squared away soldier. You know, I was still proud. I was a soldier. I was proud to be a soldier.
Yes.
You know, I kept. You know, it just. I was working with. And he sits that if not every day, every other day, beat the shit out of me, slap me, or pushing me up against the wall or something like that. Everybody knew about it, even the CO, and wouldn't do a fucking thing about it. So I had a piss poor attitude.
Right.
5:30 in the morning, and everything, and got pissed off and everything. And battalion commander was walking through, or it wasn't battalion commander because I was an AG, so whatever, support command, whatever, I can't remember now, but anyway, you know, he was coming in, you know, because commanding officer's supposed to eat at least once a month,
right.
You know, in the mess hall,
right.
So he's coming in for breakfast and everything, and so, you know, fuck this goddamn motherfucking army, and fuck you. From my goddamn mouth. So I'll go to fucking Leavenworth for 6 months and get out, you know, and everything. So they started processing me out.
Mm-hmm.
The day I got out for a month, well, that started in November, and they said, you'll be home for Christmas. Christmas rolled around, passed, I was still there. You'll be home by New Year's. New Year's rolled around, passed, I was still there. The what, you know, I pulled payroll guard in 45. And usually, you know, on guard duty, once you get a weapon, you don't turn it out until you relieve.
Right.
I guess Lieutenant Wilson was afraid that I'd shoot somebody there at the mess hall. Because when it went time for lunch, he took mine. He says, "Let me have your weapon, and I'll put it, lock it up in my safe here." So you know, I knew I was going to home. I wasn't dumb. You know what I mean?
Right, exactly.
You know.
Yeah,
now, if it'd been Vietnam, it'd been a little bit. You know, and they did something like, you know what I mean? You
and
know,
stuff did.
Yeah,
it happened like that.
You know, it might have been a little bit different situation, but I mean, I was going home for good.
Right.
But anyway, he kept coming up and he said, "Let me." He says, normally, his job was to handle the ones that was getting on what they call Chapter 13.
Yes.
Yeah. And he says, normally, and everything, I just process paperwork and I'll, you know, let them go. Please. Let me ask for a board. Let me represent. So, man, I haven't even opposed any of this. And so, I mean, you know, and I had 2 years left on my enlistment.
Mm-hmm.
2 years in about 2-3 months, something like that. I was about 2.5 months.
Mm-hmm.
2 years, something like that. I would have got out in March. Of 77.
So the discharge date that's on your records was in 76?
75.
Mm-hmm. Let me just because we have just got a little bit of time.
But anyway, I kind of find out the day when I was leaving, I had, I was standing there and talking to people in the formation and everything they do and everything. And the platoon sergeant walked over. Called, you know, said fall in, so I got out the deal and everything. Then he called it to attention, called everybody to attention, told them to present arms. He turned red, and all sleepy. So,
nice.
You know, that's cool. Big freaking deal, right? But I mean,
to me, it is.
But anyway, kind of find out the. One officer that was in charge of personnel, he was a sergeant, then he became a warrant officer. He knew me, and he told me that morning, he said, the reason why it took so long to process you out, he said, because the general wanted you to ask for a board, because he said, with your record, and what the general's son worked as a civilian in the mess hall because it, so he knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he had talked to the general.
Hmm.
But yet the general cannot influence.
Can't order the.
Can't. You know, you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
That would be undue.
Yes.
Influence.
Yes.
But he knew, you know, and this is what the officer told me. He says, with your record, he looked at your record. Of course, he had to because he had to sign off on it.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, but your record and everything, yeah. Two years in battle,
mm-hmm.
all this stuff and everything. So, but it, like I said, at the time, you know, maybe the Lord, I'll just have to say the Lord had another path for me to go.
Let me just update this to confirm that now, Paula, you are active with TAVA. Can you tell me just a little bit about that?
TAVA is, what time did you got? Oh, okay. I got the cab. I told him to pick me up at 5.
Okay.
So I don't have to call for a cab.
Okay.
TAVA stands for Transgender American Veterans Association. It is for the lesbian, gay, bi, transgender, either intersexed, cross-dresser, male to female, or female to male, transsexual.
When was it formed?
It was formed 3 years ago.
Okay.
It was formed because the Monica Hounds and Angela Brightfeather was the one that formed it. Well, actually, Angela formed it. I mean, Monica formed it. And Angela, they were on some other gay organization, and they were with the purpose of, the organization was more concerned with the gay and the lesbian and not the transgender, mm-hmm. so they broke off to make it for the transgendered.
And to create TAVA
right,
on its own.
To create to TAVA as its own.
Can you say how many members you have right now? I'm sure there are a lot of people who are reading the website and so on, but in addition...
Last time on the... About 100, between 130 to 150.
Wow. And
we have a World War II transgender person.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, whenever TAVA was made, the goal of them was to one day present, have the transgender brothers and sister present a wreath at Arlington National Cemetery. Last year was the first year we had 60 people, 50 transgender veterans, both male to female and female to male. And 10 significant others.
Mm-hmm.
We presented the went to the wreath. We had it got out. We tried it. We put it out on the web and everything like this. And how I found out about it is through another website about sexual reassignment surgery website,
mm-hmm.
and mailing lists. And as soon as this was in January of 2004, as soon as I heard about it, I signed up, I made my reservations, and I said, I'm going. And it got out. Somebody, CNN did a story about us, even though, what's that guy on? The big fat guy on radio that's got a big mouth and
Rush Limbaugh.
Yes. Flash Rush, please. You can edit that out if you want to.
No, that's all right. If you want.
Anyway, Rush Limbaugh read the news piece from CNN.
Yes.
He didn't even serve in the National Guard. At least the president served in the National Guard. And, I mean, you know, he got up and he's coming. Yeah, I'd like to see these treating junior veterans out there carrying a weapon. Hey, buddy, where was you when we was over in Vietnam getting our sweating our ass off, getting beaten by leeches, getting shot at, booby-trapped, you know, bring it out. Mm-hmm. Bring it out.
And how important was it for you, Paula, to be there and present that wreath and be part of that?
Very important.
Why? Can you say a little bit about why?
We have served, transgender veterans have served since the Revolutionary War. We have been in every war, a revolution, war, conflict since the creation of this country. We are, I served as a man, and I'm proud of that service, but I was served as a woman, you know. It's different. At that time, I've always been like this. But they are part of the ODL. We'll make a quote, man out of me. Well, what is a man?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And you're...
If they call me back in, I know they won't because of my disability rating and everything. But, I mean, if they call me in, I'd go in again.
And was it important to you to be able to do this not just for yourself, but then for the others?
But also to recognize the ones that are buried there, we're trying to work out and everything, and the plans is hopefully in 3 years we will go to Normandy and present with the other allied. We have already got in touch with the organization, and the reason why we go TAVA USA is because there is another transgender veterans organization that's British and Canadian, and so we wanted ours to be that. We are just strictly American.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, but yet we have, in conjunction with the, you know, the other allied transgender persons and everything,
did you
go there and present it?
Paula, did you mention to me that there were folks there who gave you a hard time there at Arlington when you were presenting?
Yes.
Can you tell a little bit about what?
Actually, the ones, all the people there that was at the cemetery and everything like this, every one of them, of course, a lot of it, at that time when we had it, there was a couple of other gay or lesbian organizations that were having meetings, so they were there, but there was also non, if you want to say, quote, straight, regular visitors there.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't give us any grief, but going to it and everything, I walked past, and the ones that gave us a grief were supposedly Christians.
Tell me about the little girl, if you don't mind.
We were sitting there, me and Darlene were sitting there, and there was this waiting for the wreath laying ceremony. And it almost didn't go off because whenever we had four presenters for the wreath. And when they got there an hour before the deal.
Yes.
When they got there, they couldn't find the wreath.
Oh, I remember something about this, yeah.
So, luckily, the sergeant major, he did his sergeant major deal. He says, "Oh, girl, what you have to do, get off, you know, chew a little bit, and guess what? It showed up." But anyway.
So it mysteriously disappeared, but then...
It mysteriously, you know, it was found. And everything. And what was bad, we tried to call the florist. They said, well, quote, it was not delivered, quote, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And the florist it was closed for the weekend.
But mysteriously it reappeared.
Yes. Yes. But anyway, we were sitting there, and this little black girl sitting there, 13-year-old black girl from Ada, Oklahoma, she sat there. She said, "Are you here with the? Are you here with Tava?" She must have heard something about her. Something. Mm-hmm. Are you here to present a wreath? That's what she did. And she said, "I said yes, we are. Yeah, we're here with the Tata. And she asked, she said, what is that? And I said, it's Transgender American Veterans Association. We're going to present a wreath to honor our other deal. She says, hey, that's cool. And she says, you know what? And I says, well, where, you know, she said, well, where, you know, where are you from? And Darlene, she didn't want to, me, I did, well, Ashley, she was pretty cute, and she was, I thought she was about 18 or 19 years old, so, you know, I'm hitting, you know, kind of flirting with her.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I says, oh, I'm from Lubbock, Texas. And I said, where are you? Or no, I says, where are you from? She said, I'm from Ada, Oklahoma. And I said, hey, cool, that's not too far from where I'm from.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, where is that from? And I said, where are you? And I said, I'm from Lubbock, Texas. And she says, oh, she said, well, she says, where, I never, you know, where is that? And I said, you know where Amarillo is? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, we're south of Amarillo in the Panhandle, you know, and everything. She says, I says, we're north of, I said, you know, north. She says, oh, I know where you're talking about now and everything. So we got talking. She says, I says, you know, she says, I said, what are you doing here? And she said, well, I'm here with my sixth grade sixth grade class, is the way she put it. And so that's why I thought, well, she was, of course, like I said, you know, I'm sorry, but girls grow up a lot, develop a lot quicker than what they did when I was growing up. I'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm. So you found out she was just a kid.
Huh?
You found out she was just a kid, really.
I found out later that she was just a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so I said, well, you know, and she said, well, what I'm here for is that we were supposed to write down the name of some of the people that were on the killed and on the wall in Vietnam. And she said, did you serve in Vietnam? And I said, yes, I did. And I said, I served 2 years in Vietnam. She said, instead of writing the name down, I'd rather have living veterans put their name down and talk about them than the dead. And so I wrote my name down, and I did put, you know, my male name.
Mm-hmm.
And I put the unit I was in and the years I was there.
Now, she was asking you to sign a T-shirt or something that she
right.
had?
She had a T-shirt.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty meaningful.
That is. And whenever the sergeant came up, but everybody cried, even me. This wreath is presented by the American Transgender Veterans Association of the United States in honor of their brothers and sisters that had fallen before them. Lightning bolt did not strike us. The ground did not open up and swallow us up. There wasn't any booze or anything like that. See, I told you I was going to cry.
It's all right. It was a proud moment for you.
It was.
And I'm sure for the other.
A dream. One person's dream shared with, you know, other veterans and everything. And we did it again this year. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to go.
But you're planning to go to Normandy?
If we get it, yes, I am.
Paul, let me ask one more question.
Paula, please.
I'm sorry, Paula.
That's all right.
is there anything that I haven't asked you in this interview that you would like to just add as a postscript to everything that you've shared with us so far?
I'm glad you brought out the fact that I'm transgender, because we have, like I said, we have served in every, we are still serving.
Yes.
One of my sisters, whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
just completed a year in Iraq. And she has come up and she's retiring. But
it's important that we add this to
still,
the record.
There's still, you know, I just found out today before I came here and everything that the Thai Army is finally changing their regulation, allowing transgender persons to serve on active duty. Denmark allows gays, lesbian, transgender persons to serve. England does too. All our allies, we are the only major power in the world that still has a homophobia and fear of letting an American citizen and treating us like second-class citizens.
Well, I'm glad that through the Oral History Project here we can honor your service, and that's our goal. Thank you for participating.
Thank you.